Welcome, this I'd like to start the meeting now. Come with Vanny, I'll be opening up the subject of the Tory party, the aristocratic party, which is now a party of all ranges of the capital system.
Well, comrades, that word Tory, as far as I'm aware, originates in Ireland. It was a word that they used to describe certain people. I just can't remember who these people were, what they were. Maybe somebody here can tell us.
Bandits.
That would have been my guess. Anyway, they're still called Tories today in this country, and I'll be calling them Tories for the rest of this meeting. Now, in the 18th century, you had the political Tories coming to the fore. They were a loose amalgamation of the people, rich people, and they were active in Parliament. Their interests lay in the landowners, the aristocrats, the royalty, and their political opponents were the Whigs, and they were your rising middle class people whose interests lay in trade and manufacture. Now, I must stress, these were very loose associations. They were not political parties in the sense that we have them today. That came later in the 19th century, when the Tories came out as the Conservative Party, and their opponents, the Whigs, came out as the Liberals. But, you know, the Tories still supported the same causes, and the Liberals still supported the same causes in their case. But the differences between them became blurred as time went on. And that was caused by the fact that Tories were getting involved in what had previously been the Liberals' case. And they were getting involved in things like trade and manufacture as well. And the sons and daughters of the Liberals, they were marrying into the aristocracy. And the whole thing became very blurred, and it ended up with the Tories becoming a party that represented all different sections of the capitalist class. And as time went on, it became harder and harder to find out what the Liberals were representing. Now, there's a mystery involved here, and that is that in the earliest half of the 19th century, a great many workers, particularly in the north of England and Wales, voted Tory. And there was reasons for this. First of all, the Tories, when they were out of office, promised that they would pass factory acts when they got into power again. And amazingly enough, they actually did it. And these factory acts, they gave some concessions to the working class in terms of time spent at work, health and safety, and so on. That was not the main reason why the Tories passed these acts. Their main reason was really to hit the Liberal mine, mill and factory owners in their pockets. Their profits were getting reduced because of these acts. And as soon as the Liberals got in, well, would you believe it? They repealed those acts, and they continued with their policy of imposing very, very harsh conditions on their workers, especially the children. I mean, you know, it almost beggars belief what they did to these children. So the working class in certain parts of the country, probably most of the country, but certainly in the north of England and in Wales, they hated the Liberal mine, mill and factory owners, and they got their revenge by voting Tory. Although there was some sympathy between the working class and the Tories over the factory acts, voting Tory was about the only thing the workers could do if they didn't want the Liberals, because there wasn't a Labour Party in those days. And all of that explains this mystery. Why is it that there were, everywhere you went, in towns and cities, you went into the most poverty-stricken parts of those places, and there'd be a Tory club there. Now, most of them don't exist now, but some of them still do, although I've got no doubt that a lot of them have just degenerated into places where you can get a cheap pint and a game of snooker. But the amazing thing is where some of these clubs were. I saw an advert somewhere about 10 years ago. It was for an exhibition being staged by an ex-world snooker champion, a Welshman called Terry Griffiths. And, you know, you know what goes on at these exhibitions. You'll play trick shots and have the audience in amazement. But where it was located is what struck me. It was in either, I'm a bit vague about this, it was either Tony Pandy or Ebel Vale or somewhere like that. You know, the last place you would expect to find in this day and age, a Tory club. But there it is, it's still there. Now, what I want to do is jump into the 20th century. And I'm going to jump quite a bit, actually, because I want to open this up from about 1944. You see, you'll all know that the Tories got an awful doing at the 1945 general election. In fact, so heavily were they defeated, a hell of a lot of people, including, incidentally, some members of the SPGB and the Tories themselves, thought that the Tory party was finished. But what they did was they got down to the business of getting back into power, and they realised that they would have to smarten their act, they would have to rethink and come up with policies that were conducive to getting the working class to vote for them. I'm looking for a quote here. Got it. So anyway, what they did was they did what they'd done in the 19th century. They played the part of friends of the workers. And what they did was they started an organisation called the Association of Conservative Trade Unionists. And they get trotted out as a token workers at various Tory party conferences and so on. And to show you just how true it was that they were playing as friends of the workers, here's Churchill in 1949, a speech he made. He said, "Nothing was clearer than that nationalisation spelt the doom of trade unionism. That was already the case in all totalitarian states where they were used to make the workers come along as quietly as they will. Before the sterner measures of socialist or Soviet management have to be in force." He said that conservatives regarded the trade union movement, which they had always fostered from its earliest days, as a characteristic feature of British life. They believed in collective bargaining and the right to strike. Now, compare what he's saying there with his words and his actions during the general strike 1926, and you can see, if you didn't already know, what a crook Churchill was. Now, they did get back into power despite all the fears that had been expressed by their own supporters. And they got returned to power in 1951, and there was a big surprise in store for the right wing of the Tory party. Because during the Labour Party government, the Tories had resisted all the acts of nationalisation with ferocity. And they would be expecting that when the Tories got back, that all those nationalised industries would be privatised. Well, of course, they weren't. The Tories stuck with them for a good many years after that. And the reason for that is they knew that the only way to modernise and rebuild British industry was through the state financing it, because the private sector just didn't have the money at that time. And incidentally, this is mentioned in one of the articles in that Canadian Cumbridge paper, Imagine. So they got back in But what followed then was a period called, and you need to be a grey beard like me to remember this, the politics of consensus. In other words, the two parties, Tory and Labour, their policies were practically the same. The only differences were in the detail. And all this started in 1944, because by that time it was obvious that the Allies were going to win the war, and the major political parties like Tory and Labour were putting their manifestos together. And the Tory press was commenting over and over about the similarities between the Tory and the Labour proposals. And this was recorded, by the way, in the Socialist Standard around about that time. And somebody coined the phrase, I can't remember who it was, that you couldn't get a cigarette paper between the ideas of the two political parties. Now, as I say, the Tory right was very angry about this. They felt really let down, and they wanted to see an end to consensus. They wanted to see things like lower taxation. They're always on about that. And they wanted an end to what they called the lame duck industries, because they were being kept afloat by government subsidy. In 1970, Ted Heath became the Prime Minister. That was after, 6 years of a Labour government. And just before he returned, the Tories held a conference at a hotel in Surrey, in the right wing of the field day. They laid down the programme for an incoming Conservative government to enact, and Heath seemed to be going along with it. But in fact, when he got elected, him and his government just carried on with this consensus, and he became notorious in the Tory party for his U-turns. The most spectacular one, I suppose, would be the proposal to close down the Upper Clyde shipyards. But the political opposition to that from all sections of Scotland, Scottish capitalists, were opposed to it as well. And they had to back down. And that, allied to two successive defeats at general elections in the 1970s, well, that spelled the end for him. Heath was out, Thatcher was in. Now, what we've got to take into account, of course, is that just like any other reformist political party, the Tories are a broad church. In short, they've got a variety of different ideas circulating within its ranks. Just like the Labour Party, they've got a left wing and the right wing. Now, who would be the left wing of the Tories? Well, it would be the likes of Harold Macmillan, his deputy, Butler, and Ted Heath. He was the real hate figure of the Tory right wing. Others would be, some of you might remember the name Chris Patten. Well, Chris Patten was a left-wing Tory MP, and I think it must have been the 1992 general election when the word came through that Patten had lost his seat. The Tory right were exultant, and they called that a Tory gain. Other examples are Heseltine. Now, Heseltine tried his damnedest to ingratiate himself with the Tory right wing, but they wouldn't have him. They didn't like him. They didn't trust him. In fact, they called him the enemy within. Ken Clark, he's another one. He's tried to become the leader of the Tory party several times, and he never get anywhere near it. And I see just recently, within the last couple of weeks, the guns have been turned on Cameron. One Tory MP asked him publicly, was he a man or a mouse? I'm assuming by that what he means is, are you going to be sort of hard right, or have you not got the guts for it? So they've got their right wing and their left wing. Now, wait a minute, I can't find the rest of the stuff. Aye, so that's the left wing of the Tory party. The right wing, they've got an organisation within the Tory party. It's called no turning back, and that consists of Tory MPs who want to make sure that there'll be no turning back from the policies of Thatcher and her government. And the Tory left wing, they've got MPs. I can't tell you who they are, I don't know who they are, but they're there. You see a reference to them every now and again, and they go under the heading One Nation. And that idea stems from Disraeli in the 19th century, because his idea was we should have one nation, despite any differences of class, wealth, etc. We're all British, and we all have the same interests in common. Well, this group of Tory MPs are taking their line from him, and they've got this One Nation organisation. Now, to sum up, despite their differences, not by heaven they've got them, okay, but despite all of those, they are united on one thing, and that is the maintenance and the extension, where possible, of the interests of the British capitalist class. And for this, you've got to hand it to them. They have shown great resilience. They have come back several times from what people thought was a disaster. They've overcome these setbacks, not just with mere setbacks, but also with what seemed to be oblivion. Incidentally, I'm just going to finish now. Most of all this can be obtained in this party pamphlet here, Questions of the Day. The chapter on the Conservative Party sums up the basis of this talk. So there you are, Cumbrians. That's the talk on the Tory party. A round of applause.
Oh, Cumbrians, it's up for discussion. Anybody want to have any questions or want to contribute in?
You see, when you said that, for instance, workers were supporting them in the 19th century, they didn't have the vote, did they? You know, in the 1810s, 1820s and all that.
Well, whenever they had it.
I don't know, when universal suffrage came about?
Oh, universal suffrage wasn't until about 1930 or something.
Yeah, even workers getting the vote, some workers getting
it. Some of them got it. That could be property owners, didn't it?
Yeah,
householders.
£60.
Even after that, if you work, like I remember in Stranraer, the people that worked for the Earlist Air, they were told what to vote for.
Wow.
I mean, who to vote for? And they did it, because it was all this touching the forelock and all that sort of stuff, even in the 50s.
When was the education at? About 1888?
Don't know.
They brought out tidbits, but they couldn't read the big headings and the Times, so they brought out tidbits, hear me sound bites and these natural newly educated workers.
I even remember people that I knew who were members of the working class who thought that it lifted them up above the rest of the people that were voting Tory. There was this snobbery thing that they thought that made them sort of a wee bit superior, you know, if they voted Tory. It didn't matter what the Tories were saying or it was just this idea in their head that it made them a wee bit more sort of genteel.
An image.
Aye.
You see that conservative clubs, for instance. Well, one of our members,
Nicky Todd,
he was a manager of one of them. And when Hector Stewart was there, another party member, and they said, "What did you do during the war?" Hector, and they said, "Oh, I was a CO." So they said, what was your camp? Because they thought he meant commanding officer. He meant he was a conscientious objector.
But you know, as I say, you still have these clubs, especially in the north of England. Lancashire seems to be a hotbed of this, because it was on the evening. It was on the evening of the 2001 general election. If you remember, when Blair got in, there was a huge majority. Well, he got another huge majority 4 years later in 2001. And the cameras were going about the country after voting to speak to people in various situations. And they went to one of these Tory clubs somewhere in the north of England. And these are just ordinary working people, you know, the Clark Cab Brigade. Yeah. And eventually something came through that the exit polls showed that it was another Labour landslide. And these people were distraught. You know, this is the end of the world for them. So you still have that. And it was either Accrington or Burnley or Wannery's places, you know.
There's one you never mentioned, Ian McLeod. Sorry, way back this week.
He was another left winger.
Apparently he was very able guy. Because when Thatcher complained when Wilson Callaghan gave her a hard time, she was a young minister. And he says, well, we got a hard time off Ian McLeod when we were young, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that, but he was certainly regarded with distrust by a hell of a lot of the Tories.
Supposed to invent some system of bidding and bridge.
See, you've got to understand. We've got to understand their mindset. What's the name of that guy, Dick? Tory MP. He was always getting into the press, you know, for the wrong reasons. Clark, his name was.
Clark.
He was an aristocrat.
Clark. He's loaded.
He wasn't just screwing some married woman. He was screwing her two daughters at the same time.
Alan Clark.
Alan Clark's view of Michael Heseltine was, I quote, he's a bounder. He's the kind of man who buys his own furniture. Now, that to him... You know, he's got somebody to buy his furniture for him, you know.
I loved that castle.
That's right, yeah.
The castle. But, I mean, he was a contradiction because he used to turn up with his Tory thing, mate. Who was that Labour guy that was an authority in Lancashire? He used to wear a duffel coat, remember?
Oh, Michael
Foote. Michael Foote. He used to turn up at his talk in Lancashire and he wore his Tory and he thought that he was great on Lancashire. So he was a bit of a contradiction.
Aye, well, you know, a lot of Tories, a lot of MPs are on both sides. Apparently, they'd been in the bars of the House of Commons, and the word would come out that Enoch Powell was speaking, and he all shot down to hear him. It's a professional thing. This is the way you should be able to
speak. He was the world of thought in Latin and Greek, wasn't he? Latin and Greek, it was,
Incidentally, in the late 60s, a book got published, and I read a review of it in one of these left-wing journals. The name of the book was Angels and Marble. Does that ring a bell with
me?
Well, I'd never read it. I only saw it out of view. But I read it just a couple of years ago, and I only got halfway through it because I could stand it no more. Because this book was just a compilation of working-class Tories telling me why they voted Tory, you know? And this was Forelock tugging at his very, very worst. The reasons why they voted Tory were, these men are gentlemen. These men are born into it. These men are businessmen. They understand how the economy works and so on and so forth. And where that title of the book came from was, again, from Disraeli. Because Disraeli... consider a block of marble and a sculptor gets to work on it, and as he's working on it you see an angel beginning to emerge, the kind of thing you see in graveyards, you know. He says, well, working class people are like that. Inside every working class man there is a Tory waiting to get out. So angels and marble.
You see, the Tory party's demise in Scotland, you know, has been particularly rapid. During the 50s, you know, during these elections in the 50s, they got a similar vote to Labour. Then, you know, in the 60s, there was some ground, but, I mean, they weren't anything like as, they weren't anything like the rump that they are now. I mean, they're practically a fringe party, we have about 16% of the vote or something. I suppose that demise could be traced to the Thatcher years. You know, Thatcher was particularly hated in Scotland.
you know, there was a poll tax and there was a lot of talk, you know, about the divided nation and so on, how, you know, the North and Scotland had became industrialised and how she feathered the rest of Surrey and Kent and Sussex and so on. So, I mean, there's a nationalist aspect here too, which I think, you know, helps to account for what's happened to the Tory party. That I think that the Tories, because, you know, their policies during the 80s have been seen very tievably as an English party, you know. Now, I remember the ridiculous sight in 1992 during the election campaign. The Tories hardly really expected to win that election according to the polls.
That's right.
Everybody was surprised, you know, they went back in with a hell-filled lead. I seem to remember, now it was that petrol drunk Nicholas Fairbairn and Michael Forsyth, Thatcher's, you know, most disgusting lackeys. I remember they were wearing kilts and blowing bagpipes. Now, this was a way of saying, look, we are Scots and we are patriots, and don't think that we are exclusively, you know, an English party, you know. But, you know, it was hilarious to see that. But I don't think the Tories now even try to pretend that, you know, they're in any way representing, you know, the interests of Scotland, and I don't think they're even trying to pander to nationalist prejudices, you know, because I think they realise it's a lost cause. The Tories are just seen as purely an English party, especially a particular part of England, you know, and I think that partly, at least, you know, because it does take a bit of explaining this. Why was it the Tories were so popular in the 50s?
55 would be the high point.
Slightly. But here they are, at the last election, it was 16% of the vote, and there's no sign of them ever, you know, making any kind of comeback.
No, we can never say never, of course. You look at the Liberals. But when I joined the Labour Party in 1959, there was 14 constituencies in Glasgow and half of them were Tory.
Well, in the old days in Glasgow, a lot of the Orange vote went to the Tories, you know. White Inch. People like that.
But believe it or not, Robin, there's a lot of Catholics in the Tory party. It's notorious for Catholics. There's tons of them. Matt, that guy you mentioned, Patton, a Catholic.
They got a lot of converts quite recently.
Who'd you call that guy who goes up in prison?
John Stephen.
What's that?
St. John Stephen. Who's the guy who goes up and visits all the prisoners?
Oh, Longford.
Lord Longford, Catholic.
Tons
of the Tory party.
But he wasn't a Tory.
He was not a Tory. He was
in the
Labour.
Oh, no, he was a Labour.
No, it wasn't the Longford. There was another guy.
He was an aristocrat at Longford.
But there was tons of them that were all, you know, St. John Stephen's the guy that John mentioned.
St. John Stephen's.
Who was that?
St. John Stephen's.
The professional ones.
St. John.
Oh, aye, St. John de Stephen's, that's
the... Welser ones. I mean, I'm talking about the poorer workers.
Not all at once, please. What are you saying, Robin?
Well, maybe the Welser Catholic Western ones went into the Tory party. But I mean, I'm talking about the poorer workers that are Orangemen. They voted Tory.
But it was not Orangemen. It was Orangemen in the Labour Party as well. In fact, Wally Ross and I were amazed at how many trade unions were members of the Orange Lodge.
Well, when I was in the Labour Party, there was a poll in 1960 of how trade unionists voted. Labour got 40% of the votes. All the odds and sods, Liberals, Nationalists, etc., they got 20%. The Tories got the other 40%. Did any ever see that movie? The League of Gentlemen.
Yes.
God, it was a great movie. And there's a terrific scene in it where Jack Hawkins, who was an ex-army general or something like that, and he's planning this massive sort of heist on an army base, and he's recruited a lot of people into his organisation, people who he's got something on. They've all been guilty of something that he knew about. And he sort of blackmailed them into being part of his gang. And they held a conference in a hotel in this movie. And they were all there except Nigel Patrick. Remember Nigel Patrick, the actor?
Yeah.
And anyway, the meeting starts, and after a while the door opens, and Nigel Patrick comes in. And he said, I'm sorry, he says, but you're lost in all these corridors. I barged in on one meeting. He says there were shop stewards hatching their next plan for their next wage rise. He says, everyone a Tory. Because there was stacks of them. Dick, you'll remember this. You and me and Harry Hill went to a meeting in the YMCA in Barwell Street, 1971. It was because the Clyde was losing those shipbuilding orders to Japan and the other countries. And the title of the meeting was Crisis on Clydeside. And the MP was one of these working class trade union tokens, a man called Ray Mobby. Now, Ray Mobby got outed just a couple of months ago there. Some papers were released. You know, they let these papers that were secret get released after so many years. And it turns out that Mobby was actually a spy for either Russia or China. I can't remember which one. But he was a working class Tory. And I suspect that he was one of the tokens that the Tory party head office palmed off onto a constituency away down in the Tory heartland, Devon. And he was the MP for this blue blood Tory constituency. And he was MP for quite a while. But I got the impression he wasn't the sharpest tool in the box, because during that meeting, he was arguing that he had to preserve the Upper Clyde shipyards, because wages are paid out of profits. And at question time, I had to point it to him, no. Profits are what's left over after all expenses, including wages, have been met. Now, even if a company doesn't make any profit, it's still going to pay its wages. He didn't even know that. So, you know, remember that meeting, Dick?
Yeah. I can't remember what I done last night. Never mind 1971.
Victor.
Yes.
When Heath was in power, I just remember this vaguely. There was something that his government did that, I think it was the prices were going up so, you know, so quickly, that they brought out this thing if they exceeded the, I think it was a retail price index or something, everybody got an increase.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that.
It rings a bell.
I mean, it just happened every month. We used to say, what's it going to be this month? You know, we get an increase this month.
Because that was
the wages were related to the price mechanism.
Everything up 5% or something. Everybody got a percentage on their wages.
Because that was the time when inflation in Britain was well over 20%. That was during the Heath administration. And Barber was his chancellor. And the monetarists in the Tory party at that time were going after Heath. And an English guy who was a professor in America, Professor Walters, his name was, and he was the darling of Maggie Thatcher, because he was right into this monetarist thing. And he was so disgusted at what the Tory government was doing, what he called debauching the currency, that when he was introduced to an ex-Tory chancellor, Sir Keith Joseph, Joseph stuck his horn out at Walters. Oh, you debauched the currency, said Dale. And yeah, that's the period when Heath really, really got up the noses of the Tory faithful.
When he fell out of favour and fell out of power and that, having that position, you know, a couple of years after that, I remember I was going up through the airport, the main lounge, and here he was on his own, sort of standing around, you know, sort of.
Nobody recognised me.
No one bothering about him. He wasn't even in the VIP lounge, you know, I mean, which you would have thought. You know?
He wasn't travelling.
He was waiting for his plane to be called.
Yeah, but wasn't he, what do you call it, third class?
Wasn't he a sort of him, you know? Wasn't he bothered? Anybody was bothering
him. Well, but he was the guy that cut the milk. Thatcher got to blame it, but he was the guy that cut the milk after kids. 13th.
Was it Heath that happened to Thatcher?
Mrs. Thatcher,
Milt Snatcher.
She could have blamed it, but it was actually Heath that ordered
them. That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he was a Tory, you know what I mean? What the right wing were arguing was that he wasn't a Tory enough.
Yeah. And that Walters, he failed his economics exam first time.
And he's...
I know what brother.
What a pity.
Nigel Lawson, because the two of them were at loggerheads, remember? Thatcher actually made statements that Walters was going to do, and Lawson fell up and he threatened to resign.
If
she kept on doing it, you know.
But would passing your exam in bourgeois economics make much difference?
No. He's my wee bit street cred. He's my wee bit street cred. But the thing there was, Thatcher came up to him, Norman was talking about with the Celts and all that. They invited her up, that was that bad. And she was talking about we and us in Scotland.
Oh, that's right.
That was embarrassing, that's what it was.
That's yeah. She spoke at the Church of Scotland Assembly.
We and us.
And she got a right frosty reception.
Because she told them that the Good Samaritan couldn't have been of any use unless he'd had some money in the first place. Which wasn't really the message that the Christians were trying to get.
She was quoted to St. Francis of Assisi anyway, she got that.
Right,
and there was a guy, apparently, it was a guy that wrote our speeches for him. And
or the playwright?
That was based on a play, wasn't it?
Aye. With something.
Abbey.
Well, if you watch Downton Abbey, which is one of these very popular programmes on the television, it portrays a rich family living in wealth, luxury, and ease, being attended to by all these servants. And obviously, from a social point of view, they're doing this to all the wealth that they've collected. You never ever hear about where they're actually getting their wealth from, you know, they don't really tell you anything. It's all just set up as. They're all worried about little Mary or something in the cookhouse who's not looking too happy today and all that. I need to cheer her up now. This is very, very popular. There's obviously another load of that nonsense on its way.
In the movie.
You wonder why they vote them,
in the movie, who was the old woman that was just the head of the family?
Maggie Smith.
Aye, Maggie Smith.
That's Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey,
I haven't watched it.
No, I'm talking about the first one.
Well,
it was made into a movie.
Oh,
a title like that. That guy we're talking about, the Tory guy, the playwright, he did that. That was his script.
That's right. He's also an actor. I'm trying to remember.
That's right.
Julian something.
That's right. Well, anyway, there's a scene in it. They show you the cleavages that there is even in the Tory party. This old bitch is in a motor travelling up the drive to this big house where she lives, and there's a big do going on at the weekend, all the celebs have been invited, so on, and a motor passes by, and she says to her companion, who was that? It was Ivor Novello, you see? It wasn't the Ivor Novello, it was an actor playing Ivor Novello. And you see her turning her fucking nose up, you know, he's... Because the worst thing that you could an aristocrat could say about somebody they like was, he's in trade.
Oh,
that was a kiss of death.
Well, Jane Austen mentions that in Money Hub.
Who's this?
Jane Austen mentions that he's in trade.
Huh? And did you speak disparagingly?
He's in trade.
On the point Peter raised about them being obscure about where their money comes from, to be directly involved in trade is obviously a no-no to these kind of people, whether they are truly aristocrats.
He wasn't a pirate and he wasn't a slaver.
Pseudo-aristocrats. But they've even institutionalised it in that they have a saying that it's vulgar to talk about money.
That's right.
You know, it's only... probably the people in trade that would talk about money. So at the dinner table, you wouldn't talk about money. In fact, it's ungentlemanly to talk about things you know about, which kind of defeats me, because what then would you talk about things you don't know about? So you just have conversations that are meaningless. See, but Ben?
I'll come and say, it's leaving 22 just now. Is there any further discussion? If not, I'd like to thank Comrade Barney for his wee talk tonight. Thank you.
Oh, I said earlier, I forgot to mention the biggest cleavage of all. That was the debate between the Tories and the Liberals. Free trade or tariff reform. you know, the Liberals were a party of free trade, and the Tories were a party of tariff reform. But a lot of Liberals fell out of love with free trade because it no longer in their interests. That was all right then, but this is now. So what they did was they split away. This is right at the end of the 19th century. They split away from the Liberals and joined the Tories.
Well, thank you, Cummins.
No, no, it's a Liberal National.